I'd like to welcome everybody back to Teas and Coffees. My name is Neil, I'm an alcoholic. Just a reminder of the housekeeping, smoking outside, if you could please put your butts in the sand pockets. Fire exit, each end of the building, and the fire point, obviously the car park. The toilets to the right are the back door, and in the main building at the back. And I'll read the preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organisation or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And I would now like to introduce our third old-timer, Caroline, from Wednesday night in Newbury. Caroline, I hear Dorothy was the first old-timer you met, as you remember, and that was at Radcliffe Walk, Chelsea. And I'll pass it on to you, Caroline. Thank you.
Right. Thank you. My name's Caroline and I'm an alcoholic. And I've been asked, could we have a few moments silence just to remember why we're all here and to remember the still suffering alcoholic. Thank you. Well, as I said, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm here because by nature I'm a drunk, and by rights I should be dead. And having heard the first two speakers tonight and the emotion with which they shared on this disease, I thought I should be in tears before the first 5 minutes, because that's partly age, I think. And maybe partly because as the years go by, the gratitude for the gift of sobriety grows. And the realization of the miracle of the gift that I have also grows. Like Dorothy, and I'm sure like Albert, I've seen many people die from this disease. And as Dorothy so beautifully described, or so movingly described, it is a disease that kills. And I remember doing a 12-step call, and I don't see many drunks today in the meetings, and certainly even when I first came in, there was usually a drunk or two to be had to remind me of what my disease is about. And I'm going to share this, and it's possibly a bit negative, but when I was first around and there was a meeting of old-timers sharing, God, we'd all have been there. And I am so disappointed that there are not more people to hear. I'm not talking about my chair, obviously, but the wonderful old-timers that we have here today. And it's quite, well, I'm just sharing for myself and I'm shocked, but there we are. I'm obviously getting old and critical. The important thing is that I'm here and I don't come for anybody else, really. I come for me. Because if I don't have sobriety, I can't give anything away anyway. And so I'm kind of going to start perhaps from the beginning. And I was actually just going to share about the 12-step call I remember going on. And I remember I walked into this flat and I reached. And I really thought I was going to be sick. The smell was so awful. And that was probably the worst alcoholic that I had seen, or the worst flat that I had been into. And I saw I don't believe she stayed sober. I don't know what happened to her, but it was unbelievable. And I came in when I was 24, so I had a relatively high rock bottom. And I was saved the 10 or 15 years of literal hell that I have heard in these rooms. But for me, I personally wouldn't have survived the rock bottom I had for very much longer. I was ready to go. I'd had enough. I had no hope. and I wanted to die. That's where this disease brought me. And it's an amazing thing how we all come from such. I was listening to Albert and thinking, our backgrounds could not be more different. I came from a home, middle class, brought up by nanny, sent to boarding school. We all behaved externally very well. You know, my family behaved very well. Divorces happened very elegantly. I never saw my parents row, and they'd got divorced when I was about 9 or 10. There was never a feeling disgust. If somebody was coming and I got excited, nanny said, do not get excited. You weren't allowed to get excited. And emotions were very quickly eliminated, really. I remember a time my elder brother was going back to school and he didn't want to go, and I cried. And nanny said, what are you crying for? You're not going back to school. And so I learned very quickly that emotions were not acceptable. So it doesn't matter which background you come from, but, you know, the emotions tend to be, for the alcoholic, something that are not easy to handle for me. And so that was, if you like, my background. And somebody said to me the other day, they said, do you think, because my parents divorced, do you think it was your childhood that made you an alcoholic? No. Nothing to do with my childhood made me an alcoholic. There was no alcoholism, or there is no alcoholism apart from myself, in my family. I don't know why I was the one that was an alcoholic. I was apparently a beautifully behaved, placid baby. And when I got to my first school, aged 11, my boarding school, I was a future head girl. So, you know, I had everything going for me. It would beyond anybody's wildest dreams that I might become an alcoholic. And I discovered alcohol. I was, yeah, this future head girl, but I could not get on with other people. I did not know how to have relationships with other, with my own age group. I suffered from an inability, which I hear so often from alcoholics. I felt different. And there was always a reason I felt different. At my first school, I had a pony and they didn't, so I felt different. At my next school, they had a Lincolnshire accent. I didn't. I felt different. There was always a reason why. Then I went to my posh school, if you like, and they all lived in stately homes. I didn't. So there was always a reason that I thought that made me feel different. But actually, I am different. And I was then, and I am today. And I discovered alcohol at the age of 14. I was, by that stage, I had already had suicidal thoughts. I was desperately unhappy, desperately unable to handle school life, just unable to handle reality, really. And when I discovered alcohol, that was for me, and I've heard it so often, there was the answer to all my prayers. Oh, it felt so good. And it was neat gin and neat vodka, and it was disgusting, and I loved it. I had found the answer to my life. And what a pity the problems learn to swim. But I felt popular. I didn't feel unhappy. And almost instantly, my school grades went down. Almost instantly, I stopped trying. I stopped working. I gave up subjects. I got in with the girls that were into alcohol and drugs. And I was very soon on a very downward spiral. And my last school report said anybody in responsibility would breathe a sigh of relief as Caroline walks out the school gates, having been a future head girl. So alcohol did it to me very, very quickly. And I then went to do A-levels and things like that, and as soon as I could, I was a daily drinker. You know, it's because I've got a whole hour, you're going to get the lot. So I probably won't get to that. I'll try not to, because I've got an excuse to go on talking, so I'll probably be still at the end of my drinking by the end of the hour, so I have to watch out. I've got a clock straight in front of me, so... but yes, so the progression of alcoholism. So as soon as I could drink daily, I drank daily. And it wasn't that I got drunk every time. I didn't, but I never knew how many drinks I was going to have. Very early on, you know, this is 40 years ago or whatever it is, it wasn't acceptable to be drunk as a young woman. It wasn't like in the days today they go out and now we're all going to go and get drunk. In my day, I never went out to get drunk. It wasn't what you did. The problem is, I got drunk. But it was never a deliberate, I will go and get drunk. And very early on, the consequences were shaming. Waking up the next morning, remember that I'd been singing or making a fool of myself or draped all over some man or in some man's bed. You know, the consequences for me came very quick. And I began to realize that alcohol was a problem quite quickly. And I think by the time I was 19, 20, I was already saying, I won't drink tonight, I mustn't drink tonight, mustn't drink. And of course, the instant alcohol was presented to me, I had no power over it. I had absolutely no power. I never had any power over alcohol. There is no doubt in my mind, I have a physical allergy, that once I start drinking, I have no control. And then the mental obsession started really pretty early. The mental obsession for alcohol. And this is my story. And I was very promiscuous as part of my drinking. And my life was pretty sordid, fairly quickly. And I remember my mother saying to me, and she lived in the north and I lived in London, thank God. But she obviously knew enough to say to me, can't you go out with some people your own age? Because the people I went out with got older, more sordid, richer. And it was pretty unpleasant, really. And so I rang somebody that I'd known from school days, and I thought, well, okay, yep, fair enough. And he said, oh, come round. And they were all taking heroin, so that was it. So then I discovered I was already taking drugs as well as drinking. It was very much my generation. And I started to take heroin. And for me, it seemed like a better option than drinking because the consequences weren't the same. I didn't do the things stoned that I did drunk. And I'll go into this a bit later. There's no doubt in my mind that I am primarily alcoholic and that drug addiction is for me a different disease, but it was part of my alcoholism. And I just took, instead of drinking it, I smoked it, snorted it, whatever else it injected it. But I was desperate. It's an interesting thing. I never wanted to be abnormal. I wanted to fit in with normal people. But of course, the more I took drugs, the more I drank, the more I didn't. And I desperately tried to hold down jobs. I didn't want to opt out of life. I wasn't like the other addicts. I wanted to be in life and I wanted to hold down jobs. But I couldn't. You know, I could talk my way into any job. I could make sure I was get to an interview sober and charm the pants off whoever it was. And often that happened too. But not quite, I exaggerate slightly. It sounded good. And so I could get into any job, but I couldn't sustain it. I couldn't hold it because, of course, then I would start to get drunk and I'd be sitting opposite my boss, trying to prop my eyes open, and I would arrive late. And again, in those days, it wasn't acceptable. You did not arrive late to work. And actually, I was a trainee dressmaker at one point, and we had to be there at 8:30. And if you were 2 minutes late, that was already, you know, on the bad mark. And so I didn't hold down that job very long. And I think the longest that was my longest job, about a year, I think. And after that, it progressed downhill rapidly. So by the time I came into AA, it's funny, quite a lot came back when the other speakers talk, quite a lot came back to me about my drinking. Then when I start to share, it all goes out the window. Well, anyway, there you are. So none of it's very salubrious or very nice. Suffice to say, by the time I came to this fellowship, I was unemployable. Nobody wanted to employ me. In fact, somebody said, "Don't you know you poison the atmosphere in this office, Caroline?" That's the kind of person I was. I wasn't very nice. Alcoholism didn't make me nice. It may make some other people nice, but it didn't make me nice. And I was pretty much friendless. A lot of my drug-taking friends had by that stage gone into Narcotics Anonymous. And I don't know what happened, what man was around. There was probably some man around, in and out. So, and I just remember lying in my bed one day thinking, my life, I just had this vision of a black tunnel, and it was just getting blacker, and there was just no hope at the end of it. And I knew there was no hope for my life. And it's an amazing thing to say at the age of 24, and that's alcoholism. And I don't know why it brought me to that point so early, but it did. And shortly after that realization, I think I found myself again behind a chair in my bedroom in the morning, and I obviously was unemployed at the time, and I was just crouched behind this chair, and I had asked God, actually, on Christmas Day, so the last few years, to stop me taking drugs, and nothing had happened because I'd gone straight out and had a drink when I got home. But I had started to ask God, who I didn't really believe in, but he might be there. I'd been brought up with God. And anyway, at that point in my life, I begged this God, whoever it was or whatever it was, I begged him for help. Because in those days, there wasn't counsellors and doctors and all this sort of thing. I don't think I even knew about AA in those days. And anyway, I begged this God for help. And very shortly after that, I was 12-stepped. Some old friends of mine 12-stepped me into Narcotics Anonymous. And I went there with them, and I tried to get well, because I wanted to get well. I knew I'd get emotional. I didn't want any more of the misery of this disease. And I know some people enjoyed their drinking. Well, I personally didn't. I hated being drunk. I hated being out of control. I hated the consequences of drinking and drugging, the fact I couldn't hold down a job. I didn't have any friends. I had the most, my relationships were always an entire and complete disaster. The inside of my head was just nothing. I was nothing. I thought nothing. I had no opinions. I had nothing. My life revolved around the next drink, the next party, how to get over it, how I was going to get the next drug, how I was going to give up the drugs, how I was going to give up the alcohol, take up the drugs. My life was a succession of trying to survive on drink and drugs, and how to get rid of it, and not having a clue of how to do it. And so I had achieved nothing. I was 24, I had every opportunity, and I had achieved nothing. So I was pretty desperate. And I was, as I say, 12-stepped into NA, and I went to NA meetings, and I didn't identify with them. I identify with the drug taking, but I'm not an addict. I am not primarily addict, and I am different. And I couldn't get well there. And eventually they'd all been into treatment centres. And so I thought, well, and they dragged me into a treatment centre. I thought, well, if they've all been in treatment, maybe I'll get well in a treatment centre. So down I went to Western Supermare with my tennis racket and my swimsuit, which they did actually take out of my suitcase before I went. But so I arrived there, and there were bars at the window, and I thought, oh, my God, this is awful. And it was a dormitory. It was like being back at school. and it was an experience. And it was 6 weeks, but what I discovered in that 6 weeks was I could be happy sober. And I hadn't experienced that for a very long time. And that gave me hope. I thought, gosh, life could be good. And I didn't learn very much about the steps, really. It took me a very long time to find two examples of selfishness. I didn't have a clue about myself, the program, or anything else. But I came out of there with hope. And that was a very wonderful thing. And they gave me a sponsor who was in AA. She'd also been at school with me, which was a bit peculiar, but anyway. And I saw her once, and then I tried to avoid her as much as possible because she'd asked me how I felt, and I hadn't a clue. I didn't know what a feeling was. They were so buried. But I went to meetings, and they said, put AA as your priority, and I put AA as my priority, and I went to meetings, and we had meetings after the meetings, and it was fun. You know, the meetings after the meetings were talking with other alcoholics. It was such fun. They didn't want anything from me. They were just other alcoholics wanting to get well. And that was a really important part, actually, of my early sobriety. And so that was all great, but, you know, there were steps on the wall, and I'd been through the steps, sort of, in treatment. But I avoided looking, and I think my sponsor probably avoided looking at them too. Anyway, we never really discussed them, and I tried to avoid speaking to her anyway, and I got a job, and then I actually got, so that was good, got work, and then I began to be asked to parties again, so that was marvellous, and not that I enjoyed them, because I was far too self-obsessed. I was talking to sponsor yesterday, and he was like, I couldn't stand up in the meeting and go to the loo. I'd rather have died than done it, because everybody would have seen me and said, there's Caroline going to the loo. And it's like, of course they wouldn't, but that's how it felt. And because I was so entirely self-absorbed, and I had no idea about anybody else, and because it was all about me and what I was doing. And of course, not working this program, I didn't begin to get well. I didn't begin to get a faith. I didn't begin to emotionally get well. I didn't grow at all. And if I don't grow forwards, what do? I go backwards. And so what is, you know, for me as a, I see it so much in AA, you know, I'm a woman, and I need a man to look after me, don't I? And I need a man to get me well. That's what I'll do, that's what will work. And I'm an alcoholic, so I'm pretty insane, and he's a married one. Well, that's even, you know, so I got involved with a married man, and what can I tell you? You know, you could prophesy the outcome, of course. And after a few months of that, well, it began to go wrong, because of course it was never enough, was it? Never enough. He had a wife, and he wasn't going to leave her, so it was never enough. And I wanted more, 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 and it wasn't enough, so it didn't work. And so my sponsor suggested I gave it up for the sake of my sobriety. That sounded really good. For the sake of my sobriety, yes, I'll give up this man. Actually, it was just that, in fact, it wasn't going very well. So, but it sounded good, and I went to the meetings, and oh, and I've had to break up this man, oh, and it's all so awful, and people were so nice to me. And aren't we good at dramas? I am great at dramas. Give me lots of attention, I'm great. And but of course, after a few weeks, it's like, no, they'd all forgotten. And I was suddenly left on my own with nothing. I had no relationship with another alcoholic. I had no relationship with God. I had nothing. And what's my, you know, if I don't have any of that, I'm an alcoholic. What am I going to do? Drink. So I'm away for the weekend with a load of drinkers. The guy, actually, the host, has died of alcoholism. I mean, what an insane thing to do for a start. And they all mixed this wonderful cocktail. And they didn't mix me a non-alcoholic one. Excuse me. And I got a resentment. So I decided I would try their alcoholic cocktail. So when they'd all gone, and they all knew I was an AA, I picked up a glass and I tried it. That was fine. Got away with it that day. And the next day I thought, well, I'll try it again, because they still haven't mixed me up a non-alcoholic cocktail. There was no telephone your sponsor, no please God keep me sober, no recognition of the insanity of it, of where my head was. There was no mental defence, because I had no programme. And so the next day, of course, and they'd all gone. So then I'm drinking all their glasses, because they weren't all alcoholics, so I had all that gone down. And then I knew where the jug was, so then I went into the pantry, found the jug of this stuff, and I had the jug to my lips like this, and in walked the host. That was embarrassing. So jug goes down into lunch, and there's all this wine on the table. And I had what I call a grace, moment of sanity, whatever you like to call it. I knew I wanted to drink like an alcoholic. And I got the first part of step one in my gut, because I knew I didn't want to drink like other people. I looked at that wine and I wanted to be drunk. And I was so terrified of what I was going to do if I got drunk. And that, if you like, was the sanity, because I didn't know if I was going to kill myself, get in a car, kill somebody else. I suddenly saw all the consequences, make a fool of myself, which was just as bad as killing somebody as far as I was concerned. All these things went through my head. And I left that room, and there were, you know, I think old times, I think the definition of old timer now is if there weren't mobile phones when you got sober. And there wasn't a mobile phone. And so I had to go up to my bedroom, and I got on my knees for the second time in my life, and I begged to God, that again I still didn't really believe in, but I had nowhere else to go. And I begged him to keep me sober. And I haven't had a drink from that day up until today, thanks be to God, because every morning since then I have asked God to keep me sober, I think. And I left there, I got home safely, and then I rang my sponsor, I presume. I don't really remember it, but I did. But I do remember her saying to me, she said, "Don't you understand, Caroline, you will die from this disease." And I felt so awful, I thought, I don't actually care if I die, but I care how I die. And at that point, I'd already had a friend, 18 years old, who'd been in treatment with me, die from an overdose and be not found for several days. And it was not a pretty story, aged 18. So I, and she was eaten by her dog, so I don't know. But that was kind of, that's the way alcoholics die so often. They're not good, and I didn't want to die an alcoholic. So I became willing. And I didn't want to come back to AA. I didn't like AA. I didn't like the program. I didn't want to be honest. I didn't want to be rigorously honest. I didn't want to do the things that I knew I was going to have to do if I wanted to stay sober. But even less did I want the misery of drinking. So there I was, between a rock and a hard place, and it was not a honeymoon period. But I wanted to get well more than I wanted to die from this disease. So I came back to the meetings and I did what my sponsor suggested. And I had met Dorothy. I've talked about, because she was the first old timer I met. She was 15 years sober. And I had met Dorothy subsequent, when I was in my first, you know, a few months before. And she looked at me with a, if anybody knows Dorothy, she looked at me under those piercing eyes of hers. And I knew that she knew what I was. And I knew I didn't want to be sussed by anybody. And I ran a mile. And I never said hello to Dorothy at a meeting. And then my sponsor got Dorothy as her sponsor. And Dorothy became my AA granny. And I was not pleased. But I have to say today, I have more gratitude for Dorothy than anybody else in AA, because she has given me more time, more love, more patience, more grief than anybody else in AA. And my sponsor is now a nun, actually. And she's been 20 years a nun, so it's amazing what can happen to alcoholics, isn't it? Anyway, God didn't want me to be a nun, and I didn't know why, but anyway, he doesn't, so there we are. And I felt I quite liked to have been a nun. And I remember when I was first with people talking about step three, and I thought, no, if I turn my will entirely over to God, he's going to make me a nun. I know he is. And then he didn't. And it's funny, God's sense of humour, isn't it, these things that come to you. And then there's another one when I left treatment. Well, when I get married, I'll have a drink. That shows you how much I knew about my alcoholism. And I've never got married, so God obviously heard that one too. So be careful what you think. And but I then began to work through the steps, and I began to get well. And I remember when I was about a year sober, or just under a year sober, walking in the street, and I suddenly thought, I'm happy. It's a joy to be alive. What a wonderful thing that was. But it took me quite some time to actually get to that point. I am happy, and it's a joy to be alive. And the program is hard work. It's just that simple. Why are there so few old timers? Well, it takes a lot of willingness. But primarily, it just takes getting step one. That's the key. If I have step one, I used to go to myself, oh, this is wrong, that's wrong. She'd say, step one. Always go back to step one. If I truly believe that I am powerless over alcohol, completely powerless, and that my life is entirely unmanageable without this program, then I'm going to do what's suggested. I don't have a choice. I don't believe today. I do not have a choice. It's drink or work this program, and it's just that simple. So I choose as best I can to work the program, not always very well. But so been lots of adventures in AA. You know, I really always thought I'd get married, and there'd be various men in AA, and my sponsor would say something like, well, has he done his fourth and fifth step? So I said, well, have you done your fourth and fifth step? No. Then he's not ready for a relationship. Right, fine. So there'd be all sorts of things like that went on. There was always dramas of one sort or another, really. And I remember, you know, in early days, it's so like a sort of complete, it was like a roller coaster. And one minute, you know, I'd do a chair, and that thing, you get lots of people say, oh, isn't that marvellous? And then one person would say, well, I didn't really enjoy that. And you'd go home completely, because one person hadn't enjoyed it. That was the end of the world. Or everybody enjoyed, and I'd go home high as a kite. It's all so marvellous. And then the next morning, I'd wake up right down there again, because my ego would go, oh, aren't I marvellous? And every time my ego goes marvellous, it's not a good place to be. And so step three, understanding that, how do I turn my will and my life over to the care of God? I had to understand why I had to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I had to understand that I had no option but to have a power greater than myself. And that one, it was simpler to call, everybody called him God, so I called him God, and I still call him God today. That's what he's called for me, and it's what the big book says, so that's fine by me. And I had to understand step one. I had to understand I couldn't manage my own life, so something else had to. And human beings are imperfect. I'd gone down that route with a man, and that hadn't worked. So there was only one person who could manage my life, and that one is God. And it took me years to really believe that he loved me. You know, I think when I came into AA, I thought I was pretty unlovable. You know, my behaviour had been such, well, does it really make us very lovable? It certainly didn't make me very lovable. And I came from a background where, to my knowledge, my mother and father never once said they loved me, and certainly never hugged me. So I came from a background where there was no love to speak of. I didn't understand really what it was. Being in love with a man was really just obsession. It wasn't love. I didn't know. I had no idea what that was. And so it took me a couple of years, really, and I got a big... It's funny how there are sort of moments in our in my AA life which are real stepping stones, real milestones. When I got the first part of step one, and then actually I better do the four and five bit before I get to this next bit. The next big, huge stepping stone for me was doing a four and five. And it did take me several attempts. As I said, it took me a long time to find two examples of selfishness when I was in treatment. And my entire life had been selfish. I had never thought of another human being unless you were going to give me something. Unless you were useful to me in any way. So I do remember actually my godfather taking me to, you know, down and out's place, and I was going to be helpful, but they didn't have alcohol there, so I didn't stay there very long. So I did have a sort of intention of helping somebody once. And so my step four and five, I did the best I could on my third step four. I did a life story, it all went down. My first step four, my second step four, when I tried to do a step five with my sponsor, I just couldn't show how I felt in front of her. I just wouldn't. I just wouldn't. I went upstairs and cried, came back down again and continued. I would not cry in front of her. Because, and I hear it from so many, it's not just me being special and different, it's to trust another human being. None of us want to, because let's face it, as Dorothy said, who wants to be powerless? And to trust another human being, I might get rejected. I might get hurt. And I don't want to deal with that. I don't know how to deal with it. How did I used to deal with it? Drink. I don't know how to deal with being rejected when I came in. So I didn't want to trust another human being entirely. And again, so what did my sponsor say? Back to step one. Because you ain't got no choice. I have to trust another human being to tell my whole life story to, whether I like it or not. And so I went back to the drawing board, did another step four, prayed, looked at step one, step two, and something clicked. Something clicked. And I went back and did a step five with my sponsor, and the dammed up emotions of years began to break forth, which it talks about in the 12 by 12, I believe. And I began to see myself as I truly was, as I read out all this CRAP. And at the end of this fifth step, and it took a weekend for me, it took a very long time, and at the end of this fifth step, she read out this list of defects, and it was like she was talking about another human being. My ego came back up, completely against my will, and it's like, and I was lucky by this stage had learned to be honest. So I said, well, it's like you're talking about another human being. I couldn't believe that's how I felt. And she said, well, Caroline, there's nothing I can do about it. It's between you and God, and left the room. And it was, and I was just, and I knew there was an off license at the bottom of the road, and I knew it was between the off license at the bottom of the road and God answering my prayer again. So again, I got on my knees and I begged God. And something again happened. And I suddenly saw myself as I truly was. And it was such a relief. Because I'd always known I was a shit. Deep down, I'd always known my life was awful and that I wasn't very nice. And now it was all out in the open, and what a relief. And she hadn't run out of the room screaming because I was so horrid. She'd run out of the room because she couldn't do any more. And God had to take over and did. And then I did six and seven. And who'd want any of the defects? I didn't want any of the defects that I'd just read out. Who'd want the bloody things? They're awful. I still have them today, and I don't like them when they, you know, come up. because I feel good today. So, you know, anyway, so I was happy to ask God to remove them. I was willing to have them removed. And I gave, if you like, my response. I went back and did that hour, and I asked God's forgiveness for my behaviour, and I asked, and I gave God permission, if you like, to make me well. I said, please make me well. And that was the point, I think, when I really grew an awful lot more in AA. And it'd be nice to say that then I got it all perfectly right. Sadly not. But, you know, I make mistakes. Alcoholism makes us very sick. I didn't get well overnight. And emotionally, I didn't get well overnight. And I took a lot of what I'd done in step 4 and 5 back without even realizing it. I went back into myself. I then became emotionally dependent on my sponsor. And that was a very unpleasant thing, let me assure you. I didn't even realize I was. I had no idea that she was too important. I was putting her before God. And of course, that doesn't work. And she very sensibly sacked me. And I was suddenly left with no sponsor. And that was actually quite devastating. But you know what? I survived. I went to my meetings, I helped newcomers where I could, I did the things that were suggested, and I survived, and I looked for another sponsor, and I didn't find anybody who had what I wanted, but I looked. And another, I'm kind of going through the great sort of turning points in my sobriety. I then had another great turning point. I worked on my own, I lived on my own. And I was about 2 years sober, I suppose. I had no sponsor. She wasn't really speaking to me. And I was so alone in AA. And I got on my knees and I just begged God again for help. It's always, it does work. Anybody having a bad time, beg God. He always answers. And I got another big grace. And I got step 3 in my heart. And I realized that no other human being could make me well or make me happy. And that it was only by doing God's will, no matter what that was I going to be well and happy in AA. And that was a wonderful gift. And you know what? After that, I stopped caring about what people thought about me so much. It was the most wonderful freedom, because it doesn't matter. What matters is what God thinks about me, and am I doing the right things today? And I stopped caring about going to the loo in the middle of a meeting because it didn't matter anymore. And it's the most wonderful freedom. And so that was another big turning point in my AA life. And eventually my sponsor did speak to me again, but then she went off to be a nun. And and then, of course, her sponsor was Dorothy. So I asked Dorothy, who said no. And my sponsor wrote from France and said, keep asking. She's the best sponsor. So I kept asking. Eventually, she said yes. And so I had to look at my... Because of the emotional damage in my life, I had to look at 5 or 6 years sober, funnily enough, and it's one of the hardest times in sobriety, I believe. I see so many people go at that sort of stage because the novelty of being sober has worn off. And I'd done all the steps, but what I hadn't realized was that the onion, if you like, of the sickness had peeled, and there was more to come. And what I hadn't dealt with in my 4th and 5th step had to be dealt with then. And I had to do some more step 8s on my mother. It was primarily my mother, actually. And then the emotions came out. And I had to scream out the hatred for my mother. Oh, I'm going to cry again. And when I got that out, came the fact that I loved her to bits and always had done. And again, that was another wonderful turning point for me in AA, because I began to feel, truly feel. For the first time in my sobriety, I knew what emotional pain was. And it was so exciting to feel, because it's like coming alive. And I hadn't realized, but I hadn't really felt alive, because I wasn't feeling. And so I began to feel, which I don't regret, even though I've had a lot of pain since then. And that was the next stage of my sobriety. And emotionally, I really began to get well. And I began to deal with them and understand my disease and myself. And I began to understand, actually, that I didn't believe I was lovable. And I would keep getting this thing that I would suddenly go into this sort of, I can only call it, it was a sort of depression, but it was like a terrible pit of self-pity and lack of hope. And I used to suddenly just drop back into it. And I'd had it ever since childhood, really, and seeing my mother always did it. And I'd go back into this pit of loss of hope. And then I was in France, and we were visiting a very holy place. And actually, it was after dinner, and I was sitting looking out of the window, and I suddenly got one of these great big moments. And I suddenly got this thing that, and it came from nowhere, you are lovable, and you have always been lovable. And that was another huge moment in my sobriety, because I realized I had always been lovable but never seen it. And that was a wonderful moment. It made me so happy. And I've always felt lovable pretty much ever since, and I don't go into a black hole when I see my mother anymore. And I can rise above her, bless her, her negativity, really. And I can love her today. What a wonderful thing that is. I had to tell my sponsor, made me tell my father I loved him. And you just didn't do things like that in my family. And he didn't know what to say. And there was a lot of down the end of the phone. And later on in my sobriety, we were watching something like Casualty. And this man who was a surgeon, his son was dying on the table. It was all great big drama, you see. And he said, I've never told my son that I loved him. And I don't know why, but I said to my father, I said, do you love me? And he said, don't be so ridiculous. I said, do you? Do you love me? And he couldn't say it. And so my stepmother said, tell her. She's asking you a serious question. So the two of us, of course I love you, he said, and I'm very proud of you. And it was so lovely that he managed to say that he's dead now. And our relationship did, and it was never marvellous, because communication was not his strong point, as you can imagine. But we had the best relationship we could have. And when he died, I was holding his hands and saying prayers. I was the only one with him, actually, when he died. My stepmother had gone to get my brother, and that was very beautiful. And I was very grateful for that. So AA has given me so much. I've still got another 15 minutes, haven't I? Well, that's kind of the most. So I don't know, there have been so many. I suppose those were my major getting well points. But there's obviously been a bit. I mean, I came to Newbury came down here from London. I've been in London AA for a very long time. And I came down here and... I didn't like the meetings I tried to go to. I wanted to change, rightly or wrongly. But I missed London AA, the meeting I'd been to there. We'd started a meeting there. Anyway, I started, and my sponsor said to me, she said, and I've never started a meeting in my life. The last time I'd been secretary, I was told that I was probably one of the worst secretaries ever. I wasn't very good at it. And she said, start a meeting. If you go to a meeting and I don't hear what I need to hear, share it yourself. She always said, share it yourself. So I started a meeting and it went really well. And then it came under attack. And I was positively the most unpopular person in Newbury AA. And everybody hated me, it seemed. Texts were going round and da da da. And what was lovely was, I survived it, and it's the sort of thing that I hate being hated. You know, and I said, I don't care what people think, there's a limit. And I was really quite devastated by it, but I survived it. And I thought, no, this is the program. I'm not watering my program down at all, because it's not a program. What did it say? Half measures availed us nothing. So I just continued with it as it was, and it went down to about, I don't know, two people. No, not quite that. It went very low. And then God was good, because actually the hall came to an end, so I could close it with good grace and start another one, which is Wednesday, Newbury, midweek recovery, which is great, and it's good. And what was lovely was, with the help of my sponsor, when everybody was being so horrid, I could, because I have the programme, I was able to work the programme. I didn't say, you're all shits, and you're all this, and you're all that, you're all the other. When I saw them, I said, hi, how are you? Oh, it's so satisfactory, you know. It's really good to be able to be nice when you know they're hating you. And in the end, we're all friends. There may be a few that still hate me. I don't know. They don't talk about it. But I don't have a problem today. So it was one of those. We get these blips in AA. AA isn't perfect. You know, we're mostly sick as parrots. So there's. But if I just continue to do what I've got to do, that's all I can do. And if nobody's, and I remember my sponsor saying to me relatively early on, she said, if everybody likes you in AA, she said, there's something wrong with your program, and you're not working the program, and I believe that to be true. So I've sponsored a lot in AA. I give it away to keep it. It's rarely a lot of, yeah, I think probably a lot of my sponsees are still sober. I get sacked more often than I've had hot dinners, actually. But I won't water down what I've been taught. And as my sponsor always says, when I get sacked again, she said, but you're sober. You stayed sober. And that's the key. I've run a business in AA. Beyond my wildest dreams, really. I was a completely failed dressmaker, dress designer by the time I got to these rooms. I was a secretary by the time I got to these rooms, and I was failed at that too, I'll tell you. And so I was pretty much failed. And when I was about 2 years sober, I began to want to sew again. And the desire to design, you know, because I couldn't design, but I couldn't, there was nothing creative left in me by the end of my drinking. And I began to design again, and I don't know how I did it quite. I got into the wedding dress business. By my sister-in-law got married. I began to say, my sister-in-law got married. I made her dress, and that got into a magazine, and I was catapulted into the bridal business. And I never made any money really, but I did do very well in the business, if you know what I mean. And really, and I remember when I won an award, and my sponsor was there, and you know, we were all so and it was just. What a gift of failed. I had failed at everything, and there I was winning awards for my work. And I ran my own business, and believe me, that's tough, as I'm sure many of you know. And all my competitors could work sort of 18 hours a day, but I went to AA every evening. I sponsored every evening, so I couldn't put those kinds of hours in. But I still made it, and I still did okay. And all the things I learned in AA, I put into my business. Communicating with staff, communicating with people, the discipline that I'd learned in AA. You know, when I was in early days, I didn't feel like going to a meeting. Get to a meeting. I'd rather die for the duvet with a bar of chocolate. Get to a meeting, you'll feel better. And of course, I would say I learned discipline from AA. I learned communication from AA. Everything I know that's good, I learned from AA. And that carries into every area of my life. So it is an amazing thing. And I had cancer in AA. And you know, once I'd asked the doctor, am I going to die? And he said, no, not yet. I was fine. I was so grateful I wasn't going to die. I never really had a moment. I had the odd moment of, I didn't feel very well through the chemo sometimes, I'll tell you. But the program is such a powerful thing. Every morning, doesn't matter how ill I feel, God's will. for whatever reasons, I got cancer. I don't know why, but I had to get, I gave up my business really as a result and came down here. So maybe that's why I had cancer. Who's to say? It was certainly, I don't know if it was a humbling experience. That's probably not the right word, but it was, yeah, in a way it was, because of course, feeling so, I remember there were some days I would just lie in bed, and I'm a Catholic, and I had a crucifix at the end of my bed, and all I could do was look at our Lord suffering and identify with him, and just, I got through it that way, but without self-pity. And it was a wonderful spiritual, so it, in a way, all these things bring me closer to a God of my understanding. All the sufferings I go through in AA, and there are sufferings. It's real life, isn't it? Giving up my business wasn't easy, but it was right that I should do it, and I believed it was God's will. All these things are not easy, but through all of the things I do, if they're God's will, I grow through them, and I grow closer to God. I believe it to be a spiritual program, utterly, and of course very practical as well. And my serenity, my joy, my happiness, if you like, depends on my relationship with God and how well I am trying to carry out his will. And when I'm trying to do my will, I'm usually sorry for myself, actually. That is my default setting, self-pity, not good. It's a very unattractive defect. I don't like so people when they get angry and they go, oh, this all sounds quite good, doesn't it? But it's like self-pity. But that's the one I have to watch for. I don't suffer from it very much today, thanks be to God. I can get out of it very quickly because the program's shown me how. And why do I need it? It's such a joy to be alive. It's such a joy to be sober. It's such a privilege to be here and to be called an old-timer. Although somebody last year, they ran and said, would you come and speak as the old-timer? And it's like, excuse me, old? Are you serious? And I really was quite offended. And then I realised what a privilege it was. I never thought I'd reach double figures. I thought, because I'd failed at everything. So I really never thought I'd succeed in AA. And just for today, I have succeeded for a lot of days. And no matter, and I remember too in early days, you know, when things went wrong or I've done something wrong, doesn't matter what I've done. Have you picked up a drink today? No. Then it can get better. That's the bottom line. Have I picked up a drink today? If I haven't done that, then my life can get better and any mistake I make can be resolved. And there's nothing, and I had a poster when I was early sober and it said, Lord, help me to remember there's nothing that's going to happen in this day that you and I can't handle together. And I believe that to be true today. And I thank you so much for asking me. It is a wonderful, wonderful gift, and thank you.